Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, C.A. We're continuing our look into the myths and rituals that do so much to shape how we have come to understand family life in the society. In our first conversation with author John Gillis, we learned how ancient cosmic and communal sources of myth yielded over time to more private, family-centered versions of ritual. Now today we'll be taking the current and explosive debate over family values head-on as we talk about motherhood, fatherhood, and the changing face of ritual in a quickly changing world. My guest is once again John Gillis, author of A World of Their Own Making, Myth, Ritual, and the Quest for Family Values. John, welcome back to Dialogue.
Thanks, George.
John, as we move into the rituals of our own day, rituals that we've learned in our previous conversation, we derived largely from Victorians in the 19th century, it might come as a surprise to many, it certainly did to me, that the very notion of motherhood linked to the biological fact of bearing a child is not, again, as ancient a determination as I had previously thought it was. That what we, quote, call, or what has been called true motherhood, is, again, a kind of a late 19th century creation.
Well, yes. Before the middle of the 19th century, motherhood was a social function. I make the distinction between mothering and motherhood. In other words, women who had not given birth could mother. Wet nursing was common, for example. By the late 19th century, however, the notion of maternity and motherhood had become insolubly linked, and this is the beginning of what I would call the myth of modern motherhood, that only a woman who gives birth then can be the proper mother to a child. And we see this today even still in the prejudice that most people have against adoption. Adoption is a second choice. We talk about the natural child versus the adopted child. This language suggests that we're still very much trapped by the notion that motherhood is a biological function, mm-hmm. something that, in fact, most cultures and our own historic culture would deny.
I don't want to use a word that's overblown, John, but the impression I've been getting, particularly as we talk about motherhood now and this changing conception of the late 19th century, is the mother in the home becoming a focal point of all that's sacred, and her role sort of getting this increased sacramental distinction to it. I mean, it's almost an aura that begins to descend upon this particular role in society.
Yes, as society began to look for sources of the sacred beyond religion, beyond the usual sources, they turned to motherhood as the sort of central icon. And that's what has defined modern femininity, is its sacredness. And the mother as the central figure in our imagined families. It's almost impossible to imagine families today without mothers, even though it's very, unfortunately, very easy to imagine them without fathers. Mm-hmm. And this was almost an inversion of all that had gone before, because prior to this time, it was the father, the existence of a father that defined a family. You knew a family was there because it was a father figure. In the 20th century, you know a family is there because there's a mother present. Mm-hmm. And of course, this means a tremendous, both practical and symbolic burden upon women who are mothers.
That's exactly the phrase that occurred to me. The overwhelming burden upon mothers, and upon women generally, as kind of the keepers of the flame, so to speak, of this great traditional
Well, the keepers
role.
Of perfection as well. In other words, this priestly role that have been given to mothers places them almost outside of humanity. In other words, mm-hmm. a mother has to be faultless. She has to be pure. All praise and all blame are now brought to the mother. Mm-hmm. Again, there's a gender asymmetry here. Men may get blamed for a lot of things, but they never get blamed in the same way that that mothers do.
Because I suppose any mother's failing is perhaps viewed as destructive of the whole idea of family. I mean, the whole edifice crumbles to the extent that she's not living up to that perceived role.
Exactly. This is a faulted mother. Remember the tragic situation of Susan Smith murdering her two children. People asked the question in shock, how could a mother do this? In other words, not how a woman could do this, but how a mother could do this. Not how a human being could commit such crime, but a mother. And that, I think, suggests just how we've invested motherhood with this rather special and, in fact, transcendent, almost superhuman aura.
Because we have done just that, John, invested motherhood with this aura, this transcendent, superhuman aura, how is our understanding of motherhood or our view of it affected by issues of our own time? Here I cite single motherhood on the one hand, and then on the other, and I range far afield, and yet it is another pressure, biotechnology. I mean, when you can, when life becomes something that my scientific understanding is flawed, and yet it seems as though life can be created in laboratories and that kind of thing. How do these pressures impinge upon the traditional conception of motherhood?
Well, that's a very, very interesting question. I think, actually, biotechnology now is intensifying the pressure on motherhood in the sense that 100 years ago, there wasn't even something known as prenatal care. Today, motherhood begins with the moment of almost of conception, or the moment that the pregnancy is known, and the monitoring of women, the sense that they are especially responsible for the health of the fetus and so on. Right? We can set aside the abortion debate here, suggests that the burdens on pregnancy are much greater than they were even 100 years ago. So this is an example where technology actually burdens or overloads the mother role even more.
And in the introduction to our conversation, John, I promised that we were going to get into subjects that have a lot to do with the current hot debate about family values. I think we're proving that as we move in this terrain.
Right.
And there's no more important place to focus our attention on that than the role of fatherhood, which is an extraordinary and pivotal question in this entire discussion. I want to quote to you a sentence from the book that I thought speaks directly to your view on how we should view this problem. And it goes this way, on the question of fatherhood: proposed solutions focus on the individual and ignore the way the problem is built into the political, social, and economic constitution of the modern world.
Yes.
What do you mean by that, John?
I mean by that that by and large, men have been displaced from the household and from the center of the family into the world of work, into the public world, in the case of times of war, into the battle front. And therefore, men have in some sense been made unavailable by the structures of our economy, the structures of our politics, of modern warfare, from what was seen as their chief responsibility in earlier periods, which was to govern the household, to participate in the household. Now, I'm not advocating a return to the old patriarchy here, but I am advocating a reassessment of this gendered division between the public and the private, between the role of the provider, the male role as provider, and the female role as homekeeper.
So what you're saying, John, is until society begins to think about this overall context, these individual probings won't do as much good as the more general view could do, the more general approach could do.
Well, that's right. To ask individual men, just as to ask individual women, to solve a problem which society and culture have created seems to me to be not only naive, but in some ways cruel. In other words, what we have here is a cultural question and a social question which has to be solved. Blaming, moralizing, individualizing these things will not help. What we need to do is rethink the whole configuration of male, female, femininity, masculinity, and so on.
And just to be absolutely clear on this point, is that your prescription, John Gillis, about how this whole debate on, quote, family values should be structured, that it's this totality that we really have to look at rather than trying to fit people into square pegs into round holes in our time?
Well, that's right. I'd like to see the moralizing taken out of this. I'd like people to have a historical perspective. I'd also like them to be optimistic because, look, if the situation we got ourselves into here is the creation of only a couple hundred years of social and cultural change, surely we can rethink it and get ourselves onto a more, shall we say, properly functioning and workable terrain. So I'm not a pessimist here. There are a lot of people who say you can't tamper with culture. Well, I say culture is precisely the thing that we ought to be thinking about. This is a very important terrain. If you can change everything else about life, if you can even tamper with genes, why can't you tamper with culture? Mm-hmm. I mean, after all, there's nothing sacred about it. It's our creation. It's the way we make and give meaning to the world. So why can't we rethink these fundamental categories?
That's a wonderful point, John. Let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of PRI, Public Radio International. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is John Gillis, author of A World of Their Own Making, Myth, Ritual, and the Quest for Family Values, which was recently published by Basic Books. John, I want to turn us to the most dramatic and perhaps indeed somber topic of all, and that is the question of death, which we cannot ignore, and which, of course, is in many ways the ultimate mystery. It's E.M. Forster, the novelist, called it the great explainer, but we seem to be constantly searching for the meaning of it. And I wonder, in that search, as compared with the way people understood it or treated it in times past, have we created, John Gillis, a modern cult of the dead in the society?
Yes, we have. And I'm delighted that you've brought this up, George, because this is something that most interviewers have avoided, actually. One of the discoveries that I made in researching this book is how important the dead are to us. The dead, in some sense, are a realm or a resource that we use to supplement our otherwise fragmented and segmented family life. This may seem strange to many people, but the dead are, in some sense, our imagined families. They are the good dead, in contrast to the dead of the past, which sometimes haunted and bewitched and so on. The dead today are a very friendly presence to most people, a consoling presence. We seek them out, we haunt them for to fill the gaps that our real, live family can't provide.
It's kind of an iconic function, John. I mean, when you go into a family home, I think of my own, and you see the pictures of, as you put it, the good dead, those who are revered, kind of a glue that holds the survivors together or helps to?
Yes. The memory, you see, is something we can share with other members of the family. They can be thousands of miles apart, but we're sharing the memory of an ancestor or the memory of a family event. So that the dead provide us with a glue. I think that's a very nice metaphor, a glue which life does not. Mm-hmm. So we're investing more and more energy, for example, in the way we treat the dead, in the way we keep them alive through photography, through memoir, through biography. We have perfected the cemetery. We've even perfected the notion of heaven. I can't share in this belief, but the majority of Americans believe they will be joining their family in heaven. In the 18th century, heaven was populated by God and his family. Today, heaven looks more like a suburb with each family of the dead together, pets included, than it does the traditional notion of heaven.
More anthropological heaven.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
John, what about death itself as opposed to the dead? You've explained quite well this reverence for both the good dead, but death itself, I mean, you mentioned earlier in our first conversation how previous generations considered themselves equidistant from it, something could happen at any point and therefore was a presence, so to speak, in their
that's
lives.
Right.
Has it become viewed differently now?
Well, that's the paradox, George, that we deny dying and physical death. We have cordoned that off. We've placed it out beyond the bounds of our experience for the most part. While at the same time, the dead who are no longer with us have become more of a presence. Now, how do you explain that paradox? The dying has become the unthinkable. Mm-hmm. But the dead have become more thinkable over time. Now, there's been some changes in this. The dying awareness movement, the hospice movement, appear to be bringing the dying back into the realm of life. And that's, I think, a very good thing. But the dominant trend in modernity has been to distance ourselves from the dying while at the same time embracing or haunting the dead.
This is striking stuff, John. But you do think, and I want to make sure I've got this correct, that this distancing from the fact of death and this setting apart or ignoring the community of the dying may be changing as things like AIDS and these other diseases force us to think of it more as a presence again, more as a matter of community again.
Yes, and I think this is one of the most positive things that's happening in our society today. Obviously, in some sense, it's part of the demographic revolution of longevity. The dying are with us. All of us have them in our lives and expect to be in that place one of these days. So in some sense, this is inevitable. But it's also a cultural change. It's something that many brave people are out there helping to create. It's not something that is natural. It is a cultural construction.
And as a cultural construction, and in the sense of this particular culture of ours, which, of course, is a diverse one, as we both know, I want to probe something you mentioned earlier, John, and that is the demographic influence on this. And here in the question of death, and the particular example of the Latino community, and perhaps some of the rituals developed by that group elsewhere that may now be influencing how the rest of us look at this question.
Well, here the Latino community, I think, has something very powerful to contribute, and that is their traditional notions that that dying and living are a part of a continuum, that the dead are among us, that we can, in some sense, share with them. But I think there are other groups. For example, the gay community are pioneering on a frontier of dying. And contributing many positive insights that those of us who are not gay or not threatened by AIDS so directly can share in.
Sharing. That word's important, John. I had a sense of nostalgia, perhaps somewhat misplaced, because I'm not sure I ever really experienced this to this degree in my own life. But that notion of community, which guided this whole question of how these great questions were looked at, the shared sense of them beyond even the nuclear family, I thought was very compelling. And are you suggesting or thinking or wondering if we are perhaps going to be able to move back into that direction as we look at some of these issues, as we live with them?
Well, community is one way to go, although it's pretty fragile. My own sense is that we'd probably be better off working with the materials of family cultures as we know them. That this is where most people are invested today. This is where most of the energy goes. I think there are a lot of people out there, I like to think of as pioneers, who are really reinventing some of our most fundamental rituals, making them more inclusive, making them more egalitarian.
Give us examples of that, John.
Well, I think that, for example, Christmas has opened up a good deal. It has become a broader, more inclusive phenomena. I think there are several other moments in life that have, for example, the birthday parties seem to be proliferating, but they also seem to be expanding beyond the family into friendship. Friendship, it seems to me, is one of the great undervalued domains of life. But now it seems to be being included in some of these reworkings of family rituals. I think that's very positive. You know.
Let me give you my example of that I took from the book I thought was very interesting. Birthdays in communities that are in which the population is largely an aged one, where they celebrate everyone having a birthday in a given month, to create, and this is a phrase I'm going to introduce right now, a time convoy, is it, John?
Yes, time convoy. Yeah. Yes, right.
What's that
about? Well, that's a very interesting concept, which is not mine. I can't patent it, but it's the idea that One of the things we have to master is time. And of course, time is terrifying. Time is aging. Time is devolution. So how do we do this? Well, we form convoys. We associate with other people in a similar situation. Elderly people today are increasingly celebrating common birthdays so that they can celebrate together good old age. Not that they're 89 or 90, but they have survived. They have come through. Mm-hmm. And I think this is very positive. I think we should probably all adopt this and mm-hmm. have common birthdays. I think it'd be a wonderful thing to spread right out through society.
Well, quite frankly, it was one of the things I took from the book that I would like to be a part of.
Yes, exactly. I think it would be wonderful, yes.
You know, John, we spoke very importantly in our first conversation about the point at which things changed, that being the mid-19th century industrial revolution, political revolution, and the effect all of that had on notions of the family. And I might have mentioned at that time, and I certainly do want to mention now, that I'm struck by how much in flux our own times are, with questions of globalization and these yes. enormous migrations of population and countless other changes. Do you see these times as disruptive and as fertile as those? And if you do, will it be as productive of change as those were?
Yes, I do. In fact, I the way I structure the book really is to think about the pre-industrial period followed by this remarkably revolutionary moment in the 19th century. And then I think I actually do think that we've approached and are in another revolutionary movement, a continuation of the Victorian Revolution in some ways, but its own turning point. So, yes, we are at a moment when all over the Western world, people are taking a second look at the cultural traditions and practices that were invented by the Victorians. They're not throwing them away. They're not discarding them, but they're reworking them to fit new family patterns, new patterns of divorce, step-parenthood, blended families, and so on. And I find this a very, very positive moment. Mm-hmm. You can't walk into a bookstore now without finding an array of self-help books on how to, you know, rework your Christmas, how to make a family vacation better, and so on. Some of these are obviously crassly commercial productions, but behind it all is a yearning to remake this culture in a fundamental way.
And you find this a very hopeful, fervent moment, John?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Is it also a more universal one than the mid-19th century, simply because we are in so much better communication and answers may be coming from very different places than in the past?
Well, that's right. And we're open now to answers from various groups that were once considered, to say the least, lower class, minority groups. They're all having a say. They all have something to say here. And as I mentioned before, I think some of the groups which were perhaps most marginalized in the past, gays and lesbians, African Americans, Latinos, Asians, have a lot to teach the mainstream traditional culture. And people are listening. I think we are a more open society, and we need to give ourselves permission to be even more open in this respect.
And in that openness, and with these new actors, these new influences, does that mean, as kind of a bottom line, John, that our very notion of what, quote, the family is, has undergone substantial redefinition?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Take single parenthood, for example. 20 years ago, this was thought of as a lower class, a minority phenomena. Today, there are more white single parents than there are minority single parents. So obviously, groups have a lot to learn from one another. Yes, absolutely. The definition of family is changing. It's broadening. It's being more capacious. People are taking a look at one another's family patterns and saying, yes, there's things there that I like. There's things there I don't like. And in some sense, that's generated the family values debate. But behind that debate, I think, is an understanding that something fundamentally is going on.
I want you to keep that in mind, John, as I ask the concluding question of our conversation, which I must say I've vastly enjoyed. The notion of family, changing but eternal, and its importance to us. And we concluded our first talk, John, with a very eloquent statement by you of the personal importance of this topic, both in terms of your writing the book and its meaning to the rest of us. I'm wondering now about what you might say about the social interest, that is to say, the interest of the larger society in this question of the family and what the larger society should provide the family to meet that interest.
Well, I'd answer that in on two levels. I do believe that the family we live with, the biological, the marital, the constructed family, needs an awful lot of resources to survive today. And I don't want for a minute to distract from the need for public policy to recognize that, for economic policy to recognize the need for good jobs, high-paying jobs. At the same time, I think we need to think about the dimension that I've been stressing here, that is that if family is the locus of our existential sense of well-being in the world, if family today is, in a sense, our most important cultural resource, then public policy also has to attend to that. It also has to attend to the possibility of enhancing people's capacity for cultural creativity. Family history, for example, can contribute enormously to this. But there are all kinds of ways in which our society should be encouraging people in the creation of true family values. That is not one set of family values, one set fitting all, but a diversity of family cultures in which everyone shares in creating a sense of their well-being, their place in the world, being at home in an otherwise very difficult time and place.
John Gillis, I want to thank you so much for being with us on Dialogue, and I certainly want to recommend your book to everyone. It is A World of Their Own Making, Myth, Ritual, and the Quest for Family Values. Thanks again, John Gillis.
Thank you, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was John Gillis, author of A World of Their Own Making, Myth, Ritual, and the Quest for Family Values. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Karen Reed, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Smithsonian Productions. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.